know I can't be the only one who has been talking to another human being and recognizing how irrational their thinking process is. You say tomato, they say tomato, and they have to be in control, and they have to be right, and it's like A plus B equals C. If you remove B, you remove the equation.
Finally, a psychotherapist that focuses on helping people strive for self-awareness and thrive for self-satisfaction with their place in the world. It's a show for real people with real lives with all the drama, trauma, and chaos that life can throw at you. Here she is, Dr. Bev.
Welcome back to my guest, Ray Matthews, to continue and have another dialogue in a different kind of way about think, feel, do. Welcome again, Ray. How are you?
Oh, just fine. Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be back.
I am glad to have you back. We got a lot of people asking for more. And so I'm glad that you are scheduled. So let's just get right with it, because we've got a lot that we want to cover. You sent, and I saw this on, you sent to me a copy of a graph, and it's called Think, Feel, Do. Don't worry, audience. Ray has already given me permission to put a copy of that on the show page. So look for that on Monday at America Out Loud, Dr. Bev, Emotions Are Us, and you will be able to see the diagram that we're talking about today. Ray, first of all, tell me, think, feel, do, thermostat. What's the connections between thoughts, feelings, and actions?
Well, like we talked about last week, there's three things I always tell people. One, thoughts cause feelings, not events. Thoughts cause feelings, not events. Two, attitude's always the father of behavior. You never do anything without having a thought first. And then the third thing we always say is that your behavior will tend to follow your emotions toward your life events. So if you're angry, you tend to act like angry people usually do. And that's the whole basis. And the whole idea is that it goes in sequence like that. Something happens, and then you generate thoughts about that. And sometimes that'll cause you to generate some feelings or emotion, which we call energy to move. And then that ends up, the thoughts and feelings tend to drive your behavior to do something. And what the nice thing about the think, feel, do thermostat is, it's like those old-fashioned thermostats where you can turn it up or down. And by turning up your thermostat, you tend to cause yourself to become irrational. And I usually define rational and irrational in a real simple way. Rational just means that what you think, feel, say, or do makes your life better and the lives of other people better. And when you're irrational, just something you think, feel, say, or do makes their life or your life worse. And that's a real simple definition of it.
That is very simple. And think, feel, do, as you said, it all starts with what we think about. Perhaps we're thinking about a need, a necessity, a demand. I need to get a new job. I need more money. And then we use verbs as in your, as described in your diagram, that we need, have to, should, can't, or we shouldn't. And that leads us to thoughts. Awful. It makes us think awful. Can't stand it. I don't want to feel this need, necessity, demand. And then it leads us to feelings, which is anger, anxiety, depression, shame, and guilt. That's some heavy stuff.
Yeah, it could, I would urge your listeners, if they have a piece of paper in front of them or handy, I'd take it and turn it on its side and just create three columns and three equal size rows. So you'd have nine sections. And then as we go through this, it would probably be helpful for them to just kind of fill it in the way I described. For example, on the do column, at the bottom, you'd put do nothing. The bottom is do nothing. The middle is respond. And then the top is react. And then in the field column, there's a whole bunch of different ways we could do that. At the bottom, you'd put calm. And then above that, you could put something like frustration, irritation, annoyance. And above that would be anger at the top. Now, you could make a couple different versions of this. Another version would be bottom would be calm. Then the middle would be concern. And then the top would be anxiety. And another version would be the bottom would be calm. The middle would be sad. And the top would be depressed. And a last version would be the bottom would be calm again. Then the middle section would be regret and remorse. And then the top would be shame and guilt. And the whole point is, as you turn your feel thermostat up, you're more likely to start reacting or overreacting to what's happening. And that's a problem. Now, emotion is energy to move, to help you deal with, to help you get what you want and need, and to help you deal with threats in life. So obviously, the bigger the threat you have, the more emotion to move or energy to move you'd want to have. So that's the way it kind of works. So if you turn your feel thermostat up, you're going to be more likely to react. Now, the problem with reacting is if your life's in danger, that could be a good thing. It could save your life. But when you start reacting, you stop considering consequences before you act. And you're also more likely to violate your own morals and values and do some things you might not normally agree with or like afterwards. I always think of the Incredible Hulk. You know, Dr. David Banner is a mild-mannered, very moral person. When he hulks out, he has all this energy to move. And anger is like emotional nitroglycerin. It's intended to be that way to help you fight and deal with threats. It's part of our fight or flight response. So as you turn your feel thermostat up, then you're more likely to start reacting. When you start reacting, you can make a lot of mistakes. I used to have a saying as a teacher that there's two ways to make something you don't like worse: do nothing and overreact to it. And most people, most teachers, most parents, most people in general tend to do the latter. They tend to overreact to situations. And they do that because they generate much more emotion than is probably helpful or necessary.
And also, if I may add there, that yes, people tend to overreact first, especially when they haven't done work on themselves, when they haven't gone inward into themselves and did that emotional work, went to see a therapist, went to a group, whatever, anything to help them out of the dysfunction that they are in. Because I find, especially in my practice, those with shame and guilt and anger, depression, it appears that, you know, it's almost like a tea kettle. They can only take so much and then they explode. Well, for some people, they can only take a minute and then they explode. For some, their anxiety can carry them along a little bit and then it might take an hour, or it may take someone in a personal relationship just, you know, poking at them, you know, ridiculing them, denigrating them, and they begin to feel shame and guilt, and they get defensive, dysfunctionally defensive. They overreact.
Well, that's why we, in rationally motivated behavioral therapy, what we do is we focus on the thoughts that people have. And there's Dr. Albert Ellis, who developed rationally motivated behavioral therapy, came up with a pattern. He noticed a pattern to the way people think when they do generate too much emotion and start to react to life instead of respond to it. By the way, the word responsibility, I like to hyphenate it, because what the word really means is the ability to respond to life instead of react to it. And when you generate too much emotion, you become less response able. You're less able to respond to life in the best possible way, and you start to react to life, and that's when people make mistakes.
I so agree with you on that, in that in my Gestalt principles, I have five of them. Number four is take responsibility. Take responsibility. And what I had come to find out, and the reason why I wrote that as part of the Gestalt principles, was because people have been told all their lives since they're little children, you know, you need to be more responsible, you know, take responsibility, but not really, especially if you're growing up in a dysfunctional household, you have no idea what that really means. And you break it down as do I, and that it means take your ability to respond, do something.
And keep the emotions down so that you're free to respond. Because as you turn that field thermostat up, you become less and less able to respond. Then eventually, if you're angry, really raging, like the Incredible Hulk, then you're just reacting to everything. And that's when people make mistakes. You know. There are four basic types of thoughts that he came up with or identified. One was called demandingness. Another one was called awfulizing. The third one was called can't stand it-itis. And the fourth one was called label and damning. And what I'll do is go through each one of them, try to show how they relate to how people feel and how they end up behaving. Now, with the demanding, this is the most important one. Because there's three basic ways. Now, if somebody has a piece of paper in front of them and they have the column for think, at the bottom of that, the bottom section, the bottom third of that, you'd put don't care. In the middle section, you'd put want, prefer, and desire. That you want something to be a certain way, you prefer it be that way, and you desire it be that way. And at the top section, you'd put need. You think it's a need, it's a necessity, and then you demand it instead of desire it. And within those sections, you can change, you can go from sort of wanting it to really wanting it. You can go from sort of thinking you need it to thinking you really, really need something, like air, water, and food even. And here's what happens. What Dr. Ellis said, the cause of most people's generating too much emotion and doing things that make their life worse is they go from wanting something to thinking they need it. They start to treat their preferences as necessities, and they start to demand what they simply desire. Now, if you think about it, we all need air. We'll die in minutes if we don't get it. So it's definitely a true need. Well, if you start to treat other things like air in your life, that makes not getting them a bigger threat. Now, if I simply want something and there's a possibility I don't get it or I don't get it, that represents a certain amount of threat to me. So I'm going to generate a certain amount of emotion, which will allow me to respond to that situation and try to get what I want to need. But when you turn up your thermostat to thinking you need something and then demanding it, maybe perhaps even treating it like air, then it makes it a bigger threat to not get it. And that increased threat is what causes you to generate a lot more emotion, which causes you to react. Because, you know, if I were suffocating, I'd definitely do anything to get air. And then there's a couple rules we have that stem from this. One rule, and rule number one, is that you have a right to want whatever you want. The mistakes people make, like I said, is that they go from wanting something to thinking they need it. And what happens is the bigger the difference between your expectations and reality, the more emotion you'll generate. So by me raising my expectation from just simply wanting, preferring, and desiring something to thinking I need it, it's a necessity in my life like air, water, and food, and then demanding it, I create a much bigger gap than is necessary or helpful between my expectations and reality. And that's what causes me to think there's a much bigger threat than there really is, which means my body is going to respond by trying to help me by generating a lot more emotion than is necessary or helpful.
And one of the things that makes me think about is relationships. I do couples counseling, individual counseling, and many people come in and it usually has something to do with their relationships. You know, I want this person. I have to be with this person. They're the only person I ever want. I love them so deeply. I don't know what I'm going to do if I don't have them. At the same time, they're sabotaging themselves because they're making demands on the other person that are just beyond expectation. The person cannot meet their demands. And they continue demanding and not understanding, okay, why is this relationship not working out for me? To them, they feel their demands is asking what they want. But in they're not asking. They're being controlling and they're being demanding, and it makes the other person, or it gives the energy to the other person of feeling sad or anxiety or depression.
Well, as I always, the example I've always used with when I taught with students is, you know, if I don't care if my wife leaves me and she leaves me, I might be relieved. I might be happy to be free again and not be attached to anybody. If I want her to stay with me and she leaves, I'll be sad. But if I think I need her, perhaps like I need air, water, and food, and then she leaves, that's a really big threat to me, and I'm going to probably end up depressed, or I might become really angry and threatening, which is why we sometimes get these murder-suicide kind of things with relationships, domestic abuse and stuff. You know, somebody gets that, they start to treat that person in their life like a need, like air, water, and food, which makes it very threatening to think about being without them or if they do leave.
Right, which brings me back to, as you said, they overreact. They overreact in such a way that it causes them some intense, oftentimes intense consequences. And consequences, when they come back into their body and realize what they've done, it's like, oops, I slipped, I fell, I bumped my head, and this time I might be going to jail.
Yeah, what you just said, there's rule number one was you have a right to want whatever you want. Rule number two was the bigger the difference between your expectations and reality, the more emotion you generate. Rule number three is when you start to think you need something you simply want, or start to demand what you simply desire, it can make otherwise smart people do stupid things. And we see that all the time. You know, a good example, what you just talked about, people will start to think they need something they simply want and demand what they simply desire, and then they'll do something that might even violate some laws and put themselves in legal jeopardy. An example I always give to explain how that works and why that's true, if I were suffocating, what would I be willing to do to get air? Well, anything. Now, so what happens if, for example, I used to teach 14-year-old girls, what happens if a young girl not only wants a young boy to love her, but starts to think she needs his love, like she needs air, water, and food? What's she going to be willing to do to get that love or keep from losing it? Well, probably the same thing as she would with air, anything. And that's what will make her stupid and do stupid things.
That's right. That's when your thinking is out of alignment, you're dysfunctional, your feelings are not facts.
Yeah, you've got what we call perceived needs, which means it's something that's nice to have. Love is something that's nice to have, but you don't need it like you need air, water, food. I mean, people die without air in minutes. People go lifetimes without getting as much love as they'd like to have. So it becomes a perceived need. So you turn your think thermostat up from want, preference, and desire up to need, necessity, and demand. And that's what sets the stage for it. Being without that or losing it becomes a much bigger threat than it really is, and then your body's going to naturally generate motion to try to help you out, give you some energy, move to take care of that. Except it's unnecessary because it's really not something you need. It's not a necessity, and it's just simply a desire.
You're exactly right. We're going to take a break for a moment here, and when we come back, we're going to talk about that range. High intensity, low intensity, frequency, intensity, and duration. We're going to talk about this in a moment. We'll be right back, audience.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep, but it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount or call 844-869-9958.
Let the silent voices be heard. It's the rallying call that started it all. AmericaOutLoud.com. For a wide spectrum of programming from world and political news, societal and cultural stories, law enforcement, our military heroes, and much more. News blogs, informative podcasts, and entertaining videos. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Welcome back. Ray, we were talking about dysfunction, think, feel, do, and we were moving into the frequency, the intensity, the duration of these emotions. Let's talk about that for a moment.
Okay. Well, you always want, every time you have an emotion, you want to look at the frequency, how often you have it, the intensity, how strong it is, and the duration, how long it lasts. Now, obviously, the goal is to try to match your emotion with the task at hand. I mean, if there was something really threatening, obviously you'd want more, a greater frequency, intensity, and duration. But when things, when you don't have any threats, you sure don't want to have a lot of extra frequency, intensity, and duration of emotion. So you always want to keep it at a functional level, a level that seems to match what's happening in your life. Now, the problem is because of what we talked about earlier, people start to think they need things they simply want, start to treat preferences, necessities, and start to demand what they desire. They tend to elevate the frequency, intensity, and duration of emotion. And that's where they get into trouble. So to start having a lot more anger or anxiety, for example, that is really necessary or helpful. And then we sometimes say people have anger problems, or they have, people have anxiety disorders, or people start getting so sad that they end up becoming depressed, clinically depressed. And some people just have a toxic amount of shame or guilt. They've just got way too much, too great a frequency, too great of an intensity, and too great a duration.
And I definitely agree with you on that. I see that in my practice, as I go about and do seminars and lectures, I see that. I see people with an exaggerated high frequency intensity of shame and guilt, and the duration has lasted for 10 years, 15 years, rather than 5 minutes, 10 minutes. And that is because of that dysfunction that they perhaps grew up in, and then as they became adults, felt as if this is just how I am. This is just what I do. And that's not true. It's not a true thought. The emotion of feeling the shame, the guilt, the sadness, it's not really true based on their thoughts of what the situation is.
Well, that, you know, there's that, lately we've been hearing a lot about the, where an infamous Nazi used to say that if you want to, people believe a big lie before they'll believe a little lie, you just have to keep repeating it. Well, that's what happens in your brain too. If you keep repeating something to yourself, it starts to become an automatic thought. And then that automatic thought starts to feel like a fact instead of a simple opinion that it really is. If somebody says you should be ashamed of yourself, well, that's just their opinion. That's not a fact. But if you repeat it to yourself enough, it starts to take on the credibility or strength of a fact in your life, and then that becomes a problem.
And we were talking earlier about relationships, and it brought to mind people act out, self-sabotage their relationships because they haven't done the work on themselves, and they end up overreacting and then regret and have lots of remorse. Like, that person is gone out of my life forever. They don't want to be with me. They've called it quits. And that's their response.
You know, one of the things I would urge your listeners to do is start listening very carefully to how they and other people talk. Start looking for words like need or need to or have to. How many times you use the verb phrase have to or how many times you use the word can't or should or shouldn't. And we jokingly call that shooting on others, shooting on yourself, and shooting on life, because you're always using the verb should or shouldn't. And, you know, and really what you're saying is somebody can't or has to. If you're saying they should, you're really saying they have to or should, you know. And if you're saying they shouldn't, they're basically saying they can't. So start listening for those verb usage, because when you're doing that, you're basically turning your think thermostat up to that need, necessity, and demand level, which is going to set you up for having a lot more emotion if and when you don't get those things that you're demanding and think you need, whether it be from yourself. Now, you can make demands of other people. You can make demands of yourself. You can make demands of life. And depending on which one you make demands of, that will determine the feeling you have. For example, anger comes mostly from making demands of other people that don't get met. Anxiety comes from making demands of yourself before some life event, like I have to do well on this test, I have to get this job, I have to do well on this job interview. And then also comes from making demands of life. For example, I've worked real hard to plan a party or something, and I think everything has to go perfectly. Nothing can go wrong. Everything has to be perfect. So I create a lot of anxiety for myself by demanding that of myself. Shame and guilt come from making demands of yourself after a life event where you say, I should have done this, or I should have done that, or I shouldn't have let that happen. I should have done a better job. And then depression comes from making demands of life. For example, people say things like, this shouldn't be happening to me, and it is. I shouldn't have to deal with this, and you do. And this can't be happening to me, and it is. So by doing that, if you don't want things to happen to you, that's understandable. I don't want my mother to die or my father to die, but unfortunately, that's probably going to happen. Well, if I don't want it to happen, that does, I'll be sad. But if I say this can't be happening to me, if I turn my think thermostat up, now I'm going to be depressed instead of just sad, just by simply turning my think thermostat, by trying to treat what's happening by demanding that what's happening not happen.
Right. And there's no way we can have that much control over life or over another person.
Now, one of the other real comment, one of the hottest thoughts you can have, people usually use the phrase, how dare you? Or how could you? Yeah, and, you know, how dare you?
Now, how dare you say that to me? Dare you do that to me? You should never, ever treat me like this. You should never have said that. Yes, I feel you.
And later we're going to talk about how we teach people to respond to those and correct those thoughts. Well, unfortunately, I have a rule. Never ask a question for which you won't like the answer. And that's one of those questions. If you're saying, how dare you do that to me? The answer, unfortunately, is easily. And I hear that all times on TV, like, how dare the president do that? How dare? Well, the answer is easily.
Easily. He does it. But I mean, what you said earlier is like really profound. If you don't want to know the answer, don't ask the question. This is Emotions Are Us. We're keeping it real, raw, and very authentic. If you don't want to know the answer to something, don't ask the question, especially when it involves your feelings, your emotions, relationships, whether it's with it's an interpersonal relationship, you're a lover, your spouse, your girlfriend, whatever, or if it's with your boss or someone you work for, you know, maybe you work for yourself and it's one of your suppliers. You may want to step back a moment. You may want to step back a moment and not take that intensity, that frequency up so high.
Can I tell you rule number four too? I've told you three rules so far that we teach people. Rule number four is behavior intended to satisfy a perceived need will win out over behavior intended to satisfy a rational preference. Now, that's a big mouthful. I'll repeat it. Behavior intended to satisfy a perceived need will win out over behavior intended to satisfy a rational preference. And the best way to explain it to you would be simply like this. If you want to quit smoking, that's a rational preference. It would be very good for your health. It would prolong your life. But if you think you need a cigarette, that's a perceived need. Now, the question is, if you want to quit, but you think you need a cigarette, what are your chances of quitting? Probably not very good, because that perceived need and smoking is going to override your rational preference. Now, another example would be you want to lose weight. That's a rational preference. But then you think you need your favorite foods all the time. Well, you're probably not going to lose weight. If you don't want to be in debt, that's a rational preference. Who wants to be in debt? But then you think, I need a new big screen TV. You're probably going to end up buying something you can't afford. And that's how we have so many people in this country are so deep in debt because of that.
That's why I think I need that Lamborghini. Unfortunately, I can't afford that Lamborghini. I can't even afford to lease the Lamborghini. So I'm going to step back. That's a perceived want. I don't have to have it. It's not like you said air. I need air. I can ride in anything. I can ride in a hoopty. It's my perceived need that I want that Lamborghini. Or you got that right. I can walk and walk off some of the pounds.
Before we run out of time here in this segment, let me talk about the other three types of thinking, awfulizing. Now, you could make another think thermostat with three sections. The bottom would be don't care. The middle would be unpleasant, inconvenient, and uncomfortable. And the top would be awful. Well, a lot of things in life are unpleasant, inconvenient, and uncomfortable. The mistake people make in their mind is to turn their think thermostat up to awful and think it's like the worst possible thing that could be happening to me right now. Now, and you're more likely to do that. That follows naturally from thinking you need something. Because if I didn't get air, that really would be awful because I might die. So if I start to think I need somebody's love, like I need air in my life, and then I don't get it, well, I'm more likely to think it's really awful that they don't love me or don't want to be with me anymore instead of just unpleasant, inconvenient, or uncomfortable. So that's another type of thinking that's done. Now, a third type of thinking is called can't stand it-itis. And what happens there is we have another rule. My fifth rule is you have a right to like or dislike whatever you'd like to. The mistake people make is to tell themselves, I not only don't like it, but I can't stand it.
I can't stand it. I can't stand it. How often do we hear that? Oh, I just can't stand it. I just can't stand her. Or I just can't stand him. Or I just can't stand the way he does, my husband does this, 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 and this. Wow, boy, that kind of feels really demanding. Whoa, those I can't stand it. And what's your other one?
The last one is label and damning. So what you have there is instead of condemning the deed, you condemn the doer. So basically, if you made up a think thermostat, the bottom would be don't care, the middle would be dislike their behavior, and the top would be label and damn the person. So, you know, for example, instead of I don't like what a kid's doing, I might say that little brat, you know, so that's label and damning a kid rather than saying I don't like when he does that. Instead of focusing on the behavior, I label and damn the person. And you know, even racism is a form of label and damning, because label and damning is basically blatant overgeneralization, where I'm saying it's like calling an apple bad because it has a bruise, even though 90 or 95% of the apple is still perfectly fine. It's overgeneralizing about the apple and calling it bad. And racism, basically what you're saying is that barrel has some bad apples in it. That person's part of the barrel, so he must be a bad apple. Well, you know, it's just not the way things work, you know. It's just blatant overgeneralization.
It is definitely blatant overgeneralization. And people, think about how much we do that in our lives.
Yeah. Oh, no, you can label and damn yourself or other people. Now, when you label and damn yourself, you end up with shame and guilt. When you label and damn other people, it just makes it harder to get along. And think about what's going on in this country right now, where everybody's talking about, you know, you're a liberal, you're conservative, and you label and damn each other. You're a Democrat, you're a Republican. And then what it makes it really hard to find common ground, and it causes more conflicts needlessly. And then it makes it harder to find resolutions to conflicts because you're so polarized. You're focusing on, you know, like I get this all the time. I'll post something and somebody says, oh, well, you're a liberal. Meaning like, well, everything else you're going to say is a waste of time because I don't agree with any of it. Well, even though we might agree on a lot of things if we just took the time to talk about things, but we just immediately write somebody off by labeling and damning them. We do that with kids. Teachers do that with kids. People do it with each other.
And they definitely do it in relationships. You know, as you said earlier, you know, they put it in that column of, you know, they've awfulized the situation. They put it in the other of, you know, I can't stand this, I can't stand them. And then we go down to labeling and damning. And as you said, you know, it's a euphemism. You know, we can have one bad apple in the bunch, but that doesn't make everybody a bad apple. You know, I hear women and men say, you know, there are no good women left in the world. There are no good men left in the world. Well, that's not a factual thought.
No,
that is not a fact. That's your emotion, but that is not a fact. And your thought process of think, feeling, and doing, if it's led by that, well, there's no good women in the world. There's no good men in the world. Guess what you're going to attract? No good women and no good men.
Yeah, I seem to recall hearing something called the Lois Lane syndrome, where people, women are always looking for supermen. Well, there aren't any supermen. There are just a lot of fallible human beings walking around out there that make a lot, say a lot, do a lot of stupid things at times. And you can see a lot of that in the news nowadays. But by starting to think, it all starts with thinking you need something you simply want, treating some preference as a necessity, and starting to demand what you simply desire. That sets the stage for you to think something's awful, that you can't stand it, and to be more likely to label and damn somebody else or yourself if you don't meet your own expectations. But it all starts with that need, necessity, and demand, which means you turn your think thermostat up too high. Instead of being set at where it should be, at want, preference, and desire, you turn it up to the higher level of need, necessity, and demand. That sets the stage for the other three types of thinking.
Right, right. You can either can't stand it, don't like it, don't care about it, or be in that space where you have that thermostat, your emotional thermostat, set on, let me just take a minute here. Let's not react or overreact. You know, you and especially in relationships, people, it's a good thing to say, can I get back with you on that? It's all right if you don't know in that moment. You can save yourself some time, pain, and suffering by just, let me get back with you on that. And sometimes even in our minds, we have these thoughts that we've put labels on and that we've built this whole scenario in our head that just brings us way, 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 way down. I have an exercise where I ask you to see in your mind, to visualize when you feel that feeling coming somewhere in your body, because it will usually generate in your body before you think it, or the thought, is just see a stop sign flash in your head. Stop. Let me take a minute. You might even have to tell your mind, hold on, mind, wait a minute. Let me get back to you on that. This minute might not be a good minute to think about something I feel like I need, a necessity or a demand. This might not be the moment to think about it. It might not even be the day to think about it, because you've got so many other things going on. You too can save yourself some time, pain, and emotional suffering by stopping, doubling back, and as well as doing what we're talking about here today, is giving yourself some education, some knowledge about your feelings, how you think, how you feel, and what you do. And in terms of that, re-remembering what Ray has said to us, that there are types of irrational thinking, demandingness, awfulizing, can't stand it-ism, and labeling and demanding and damning. Labeling and damning.
Are you there? Okay. Yeah, what we'd like to do is teach people how to correct these types of thinking. And do you want to save that for the next session?
Okay. Yeah, we're going to save that. We still have, we're doing really good on time today, Ray, so we don't have to race as far. So right now we're going to stop for a moment here, and we'll use this last section to talk about correcting it. And so that's how I'll come back in, okay? So we'll take a few minutes.
The goal is to deliver a message of truth, inspiration, and hope to the world, to unite people from all backgrounds and beliefs in an effort to advance humanity. News blogs, informative podcasts, and entertaining videos. It's AmericaOutloud.com, where the conversation never ends. With 24/7 streaming on our free apps on both Android and Apple. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
We want to overcome, we want to overstand what we think, feel, and do. And the way we do that is coming back into our bodies, being aware of how we're doing what we're doing and how we're doing it, speaking our truth, even to ourselves, speaking our truth, and then as well as taking responsibility. And now I want to talk to you about how do we correct this irrational thinking that a lot of human beings find themselves in the more often than not.
Okay, well, there's five basic approaches, and I'll go through each one. First one is to apply the scientific method to your thoughts. Okay, now we teach the scientific method to kids every day in school, but we never teach them to apply it to their everyday thoughts that they have. Now, when you think about it, every thought you have and every comment you make is your personal theory or hypothesis about the way life is or should be. Whenever you have a theory or hypothesis, then you go out and gather evidence and find out, well, does the evidence support my theory and hypothesis, or does it possibly refute it? Does it suggest a better theory or hypothesis? So this is just kind of a general, broad way to approach it. For example, I had a kid once who came bursting out of the school office, and he just about broke the glass out of the door, and he was all angry, and he said, "They can't give me detention for that." And he's holding a detention slip in his hand. Well, his theory is, "They can't give me detention for that." Well, but the evidence does not support that. The evidence says, yes, they can. So as long as he clings to that theory that they can't do this to me, that's got that thermostat turned way up, it's going to make what they did a much bigger threat than it really is. The detention is nothing in terms of life. And he's just going to continue to make himself angry, probably say and do something that's going to get him in even more trouble. The closer you can match your theories or hypotheses about life, your thoughts about life, the closer you can match those to reality, the better off you're going to be. For example, two good ones are, other people can think, feel, say, or do whatever they want. So if somebody says something to me I don't like, and I say, well, they can't say that to me, now I got a really big threat and a lot of things to get upset about. But if I say, well, I don't like that, but they can say or do whatever they want, that allows me to deal with reality better because my theory or hypothesis about life matches reality much better.
You're so right about that, that your theory matches the reality. I don't have any control over how someone accepts what I say, but I do have control over me and my speaking my truth. Now, they may not like my speaking my truth, me coming from my I place of being. However, that's my truth. If they get angry or upset about it, or they start to overreact, I can take my responsibility and remove myself from the situation. I don't have to accept how they take it. I can only be responsible for myself.
The closer you can match your theories to reality, the more the evidence of your life supports your theories, the better off you're going to be, the better mental health you're going to enjoy, and the less emotion you're going to generate needlessly. Now, the second strategy is simply to ask a simple question. Is that a fact or just an opinion? Okay. For example, when the kid in that hallway said they can't give me detention for that, that's an opinion. If he thought they can do whatever they want to, that's a fact. So the more you tend to match, think in terms of facts, the saner person you're going to be, and the better mental health you're going to enjoy, and the less emotion you're going to generate needlessly. The more people think in terms of opinion, the more likely they are to disturb themselves needlessly. We have a lot of that going on in the country where people are literally treating their opinions as if they're facts, and then they get really disturbed about the fact that things aren't living up to their what they think is a fact, the way things should be. Well, it's not a fact. It's just simply your opinion about the way things should be. But you're setting yourself up for a lot of needless emotion by treating it as if it's a fact, a given, or truth about life.
And that is very well said. You know, fact is not your opinion. I like the example you used of the kid who said, they can't give me detention for this. They can't give me a referral for this. But yet he's holding it in his hand or her hand, and it's already been signed by the dean, so it is a fact. You are in detention, or you do have a referral. And if you think that, well, they can't do that to me, well, you are not accepting the reality that it's already been done. And that is going to cause you some discomfort, some dis-ease within your body, and as well as your mind.
The third strategy we talked about earlier, where whenever people say things like, how dare they, or how could they, or how could I have been so stupid or done something like that, the answer is always easily. I was going to tell you there's two other ways that we teach people to correct their thinking. It's kind of like creating grammar check. This next way is kind of like creating grammar check on a computer. You practice asking yourself some simple questions. For example, and I'll give you a couple examples. If you hear yourself using the word need, like they need to do what I tell them to, well, I would ask you, they need to, or you just want them to? Now, you have every right to want them to, but when you say they need to, you've turned your thermostat up too high because they really don't need to. I had a friend once who was a teacher, and he got upset with a kid because the kid threw a wad of paper in the garbage can. At the garbage can, he missed it and it fell on the floor. And the teacher said, you need to pick that up. And the kid looked at him and said, no, I don't. And then he got all upset and he's telling me the story. I said, well, I have a question for you. Does that kid need to pick that up like he needs air, water, and food? Or do you just want him to pick it up? If you want him to pick it up, say, please pick that up. And if you don't, here's what's going to happen. But when you say you need to pick that up, then you got upset because he said, no, I don't. Well, he's right. He doesn't need to pick that up. If you want him to pick it up, ask him to. So that's one question we'd ask. You need that, or just want it? If somebody says they have to do what I tell them to, well, they have to, or you just want them to. So if you think about that think thermostat, we're asking people to choose between the two, either to be at that need level, necessity and demand, or to drop it down to want, preference, and desire, which everybody has a right to want, prefer, and desire whatever they want to. The mistake they make is to turn their thermostat up a notch. Well, we're asking you, do you want to stay up there, or do you want to turn it down? You know, if you say they can't do that to me, well, why can't they? They can't, or you just don't want them to. And we handle should and shouldn't pretty much the same way. If you're saying they should mind their own business, I would say, well, it'd be nice if they did, but why do they have to mind their own business? Do they have to, or you just want them to? If you say, well, they can't talk to me, or they shouldn't talk to me like that, well, why can't they talk to you like that? I don't like people talking to me that way either, but they can't, or you just don't want them to. And what usually happens when you ask people questions like that, they usually start out with because. When I do this in class, I always get a bunch of hands that go up right away, and then they'll start saying, well, because this, and because that, and because that. And I say, all those are the wrong answer. Because the only correct answers are, they don't have to, they don't need to, and they can do whatever they want to. Those are the only correct answers. But see, people cling to these notions that, well, somebody can't do something, they have to do something. No, they don't. That's not the way the world works. People don't have to do anything, least of all what we want, and nobody has to do anything, and people can think, feel, say, or do whatever they want to. There's another strategy as far as turning your thermostat down from being demanding to being just somebody who wants, prefers, and desires things. It's simply another strategy we teach is to practice using what we call I messages, which I'm sure you're familiar with, which means basically you just start with the pronoun I, and then you use verbs like want, like, prefer, wish, appreciate, rather, instead of, you know, need to, have to, can't, shouldn't, and shouldn't. For example, I would practice saying, I want you to be quiet, or I'd like you to stop talking right now, or I'd wish you would not do that in my classroom, or I'd appreciate it if you wouldn't do that the next time, and so forth. And what you're doing is, it's called, Ellis used to call this, putting your behavior where you want your attitude to be. Putting your behavior where you want your attitude to be. You basically practice talking the way you want to eventually think. And by saying it out loud enough times, you actually start, it starts to affect the way you think internally. It starts to turn your thermostat, your think thermostat down, so that now instead of being demanding and thinking things need to be the way you want them to be, you actually just start realizing it, no, I just want it to be. And that's okay, I have a right to do that, but it doesn't need to be. So that's another way to turn your thermostat down, by practicing using I messages, using verbs like want, like, prefer, rather, appreciate, wish.
You're definitely right. That is, for me, Gestalt principle number 3, which is speak your truth. For me in Gestalt, speaking your truth always begins with the letter I. Whenever you start off a conversation with someone that you have an issue with the word you, Y-O-U, they will become defensive. It's going to go awry in a real quick hurry, whether it's a friend, a lover, a co-worker, a partner, whatever. When you start with the, well, you do this, and you always do this, and you always do that, and you this, and you, and you, and you, and you did this, and you, you might as well just, it's over. Because that other person then has a choice. If they are emotionally healthy, they can move past it, sit there, or stand there, and listen to you go on with your you, and when you turned red in the face and about to pass out, you know, from your frustration and your anger, then that gives the other person an opportunity to say, I hear you. I hear you. I'm not feeling that way about this issue. I feel that for me, it's gotten to a level of intensity that's over and above for me. I'd like to stop right now. Would that be okay? And we take this up perhaps in another hour or maybe tomorrow?
The way I always define the difference between I messages and you messages, which are what you're talking about, is that with a you message, you often try to take away somebody's right to choose what they want to do. And that people will fight you every time you try to do that. If you say, well, sit down, be quiet, you know, shut up or something like that, you're trying to take away from them the freedom to choose what they want to do. Where I messages, you just give somebody information. You tell them what you want, what you like, what you don't like, perhaps how you feel at the moment, and you leave it up to them what they want to do about it, which is why you're more likely to get a positive response. Not always, but it's the other way doesn't work, so you might as well just stick with the best possible way. Can I tell you about the other three types of thinking and how to correct those?
Go right ahead.
Okay. Well, with awfulizing, if you say, well, it's really awful that they did that to me, what I would ask you is it awful or just unpleasant? So what I'm asking you to do, again, if you think of that think thermostat, there was don't care, unpleasant, inconvenient, uncomfortable, and then the top is awful. Well, right now, you've put your thermostat up to the top. I'm asking if you want to keep it there or if you want to turn it down maybe to something more realistic. So is it awful or is it just unpleasant, inconvenient, or uncomfortable? Another example might be if I say, well, is it awful like having cancer? I mean, would you trade places with someone who has cancer? Well, of course not. Would they trade places with you? Well, gladly. Well, then why is what's happening to you so awful? And of course, the answer is it's not. It's just unpleasant, inconvenient, or uncomfortable to some degree. Now, the third type of thinking we talked about was can't stand it itis. And the simple question there is, again, you've got three sections on that think thermostat. There's don't care, don't like it, can't stand it. Well, you've got your thermostat set at the top, so I'm going to ask you, well, which is true? You can't stand it or just don't like it? And I'm going to offer you the chance to turn it down to don't like it. because you have a right to not like things. That's okay to be there. I have a right to dislike whatever I want to, but there's going to be emotional consequences that come with that. So I'm asking you, which is true? You can't stand it or just don't like it? Are you going to die? Because that's what it really means if you say you can't stand something. Are you going to die just because somebody said or did that? And of course, the answer is no. You can stand it, you just don't like it. And the last one for label and damning, if you said, well, he's a jerk for doing that, I would say, look, why is he a jerk just because he did that? Because sometimes people do some jerky things. Nice people can do some jerky things, and jerky people can do nice things. It's not, but you don't want to blatantly overgeneralize. So I'm asking you, why is he a jerk just because of that? Another question would be, is he a jerk or did he just do a jerky thing? Because sometimes people do jerky things, even if they're nice people. And is he a jerk or did he just do something you didn't like? And most of the time, kids will say, well, he just did something I didn't like. Well, that's okay. You have a right to not like that. And the final question is he a jerk or is he just a fallible human being like the rest of us? Now, you can do the same thing for when people label and damn themselves. If you were beating up on yourself, saying, well, I'm stupid for letting that, failing that test or letting that happen, I'd say, well, why are you stupid just because of that? Just because of that one thing. That doesn't make you stupid. And are you stupid or just did a stupid thing?
Ray, I thank you so much for being on the show today and giving my audience education and knowledge that will save them time, pain, and suffering. Emotions are us. Practice, practice, practice. That's the thought for today. See you next week.